I want to talk this morning about the philosophy and theology of human rights. If you go to the French embassy, as I did many years ago to get a visa to go and study in France, and go up the back stairs, you will discover that just out of view of the public is a cartoon of somebody asleep on their desk with droit à la paresse, which means the right to be lazy there, which is an interesting indication of how the French embassy feels about the relative importance of human rights and which ones really are top of the tree. We're in a really interesting space in terms of human rights. There's a particular discourse in the UK about human rights and their place and whether they're a good thing or a bad thing that I think in many ways is quite different from how they're viewed in other parts of Western Europe, how they're seen in Eastern European countries, and there's obviously a particular flavour and urgency to some human rights issues arising out of the war in Ukraine. I'm always interested in understanding where ideas come from, and what we often find is that the discussions that we are having today have roots that go quite deep. So you can tell a story of the development of human rights from the start onwards, or you can tell it in reverse. If you're telling it in reverse, you can go all the way back to Jesus. You can talk about the Council of Constance, very interesting council, did some bad things like condemning Jan Hus, the reformer. Did some really interesting things like saying that the pagans in Lithuania couldn't be conquered by force and couldn't be forced to convert to Christianity at the point of the sword. They had to be evangelized. But what you see up until the Reformation, I think, is a discussion about how subjects should be treated that is primarily couched in terms of the duties of rulers. So the question is, there are lots of writing in the Middle Ages called Mirrors for Princes, which is thinking about how a prince should look themselves in the mirror and think about how they're really behaving and think about their accountability to God. And we see that, I think, at the start of the Reformation. We have this kind of idea that somehow it's the responsibility of rulers to make sure that people follow Christianity and follow the right version of Christianity. Now, that with Luther getting protected by the Elector of Saxony and then the sort of fragmentation that happens within the Holy Roman Empire all across lands to the south and west of here in Poland, we see this sort of patchwork where one city will choose Lutheranism and another city will choose Calvinism, and then there'll be a bit of land that chooses to stick with Catholicism. And that's pretty unstable during the 17th century and leads to something called the 30 Years' War, which was the most bloody conflict in Europe before World War I. Absolutely traumatizing. It was like whack-a-mole. You sort of had the Holy Roman Empire wandering around trying to squash Protestant rebellions, and they'd squash one, and then another one would start up. And then France, even though it was a Catholic power, decided that it quite enjoyed having a weak Holy Roman Empire, so it would pile in as well. And then Sweden decided it would join in. And but for his unfortunate death, Gustavus Adolphus would probably have swept the field because he was a brilliant general. And you get this. And the only reason the English stayed out of it, by the way, was because we were having our own civil war in parallel. So that ends with a principle, quis regio, ius religio. So the idea there is that the ruler gets to decide which religion the people in the territory follow. And that works quite well in Europe, in Central Europe, because in Central Europe, if you don't like it, you just move down the road. Move 10 miles, you're in a different territory, you can probably find a different religion that is the official religion of the state that you're in. Doesn't work so well to the west. To the west, you've got larger entities like France and what's becoming the UK that are there. And you see in those sorts of territories to the west and in the Dutch provinces that are ruled by Spain, the emergence of a new idea. And the idea here is that instead of it being the ruler's duty to make sure that people follow the right religion, it is the responsibility and right of subjects to choose from themselves how they wish to worship God in good conscience. And that right to freedom of religion actually takes longer than you would expect from the Reformation to embed. But it does embed by about the last quarter of the 17th century. And one guy who was really key in that story is John Locke. And John Locke, in his writings, you can see the progression from him being a kind of, well, actually, religion is a source of social unity, helps back up the official regime, it's a good idea, therefore, if people all follow the same religion, to him actually saying, do you know what? We could decouple allegiance to the state from allegiance to God. We could allow for some degree of toleration. And he makes the argument that becomes foundational to the classic settlement of what was called the Glorious Resolution, the Revolution. In England. Now, Locke is an absolutely fascinating and complicated and transitional figure. Which means how you read him depends on which bits of him you're reading. It depends on which direction of travel you're coming at him from. And it depends of what you make of what he's doing. Do you think he's a consistent thinker across the different fields that he's working in, which include epistemology, political philosophy, and even theology? Or do you think that he's doing all sorts of different things? What Locke does is he says that human beings have natural rights, and that these rights arise out of human nature. Now, in making that argument, and in particular, in arguing that there is a fundamental human equality, particularly between men and women, Locke is drawing explicitly on biblical resources. And in fact, it's one of liberalism's dirty secrets that Locke only draws on religious sources for making his argument for human equality. He's not one of those Christian thinkers who, in making an argument, runs some philosophical arguments and some theological arguments, and you can, you know, kind of red pen the theological ones and leave something philosophically that stands on its own. When it comes to human nature, Locke's arguments for equality are only based on the Bible. Jeremy Waldron, who's wandered all over the place in terms of his academic career, was at Oxford, now in New York, wrote a book called God, Locke, and Equality, just driving home this point that Locke is engaging in a theological argument with people who say that God has created a hierarchy, a natural hierarchy, in terms of people's worth. And Locke is gunning for that in biblical terms, and there is nothing else really there. Now, that's really interesting because elsewhere in his project, particularly in his essay concerning human understanding, Locke is an enemy of enthusiasm. He does not like anybody claiming any sort of private revelation from God. He's against the Quakers. He wants to say, we need a scientific method for understanding anything, and that means it's got to be third-party observation. It's got to be repeatable. He's complicated in terms of what he's doing and how he's doing it. Now, Locke grounds our natural rights in our duties to God, and he has a kind of explicitly Christian understanding of the worship that counts. True worship has got to be sincere worship. God is interested in our heart, not just in our external behavior. So if you follow a religion that says that what really matters is whether people turn up and go through the right gestures, then you've got much weaker grounds for religious toleration than if you say, well, actually what matters is that people are actually really connecting with God because they believe in what they're doing. So that if they don't believe in transubstantiation, don't make them do that. If they don't believe in the Book of Common Prayer, then you know, allow them to worship God differently. And there what he says is you've got these individuals with these natural rights. And he doesn't set up a kind of fundamentally antagonistic view of the state of nature, which is a state, imaginary state without a government. So whereas Thomas Hobbes is saying, if there's no government, it's the war of all against all. Locke has a kind of far more harmonious kind of, you know, imagine all these little farms that are there. And basically everybody knows where their boundaries are and everybody is okay with that. But he says, well, there would still be some sorts of things that people might do better collectively or with a government. And so you can see the rise of authority. So authority comes up from below to meet the needs of people and to protect their pre-existing natural rights. And then he says, okay, well, what about this then? Do you or I think that governments would do a better job of choosing what is the right religion than we would do ourselves? And he says, actually, we have every reason to think that governments would probably do a worse job. Because, for Locke, he says, really what I'm interested in when I'm thinking about the right religion is, how do I get to know the true God and how do I get saved? Those are my questions. If I'm a government and I'm thinking about religion, I might be thinking, you know, can I find a religion that says, rule number one is obey the ruler? Yeah, that's the question that a ruler will have in their mind. Is this religion going to help support my power? Is it going to help continue my dynasty? Those questions are irrelevant questions. Because those questions are irrelevant questions, the better chooser in terms of religion are individuals for themselves rather than rulers. So that's how he makes his argument for toleration. But because of his epistemology, because of Locke's theory of knowledge, he makes a decisive break with the classical and medieval tradition in that he allows individuals to choose for themselves the goods that they want to pursue. So whereas the older tradition from Aristotle through Aquinas would say, we can look at the world and we can see things that are objectively good to pursue. And having identified those things, those objective goods present a call on us to which we respond. Locke has got, instead of an objective theory of good, he's got a kind of subjective theory of good. It's for individuals to decide for themselves how they want to live. So whereas the older tradition would have asked the question, what is good first, and then asked, now I know what's good, what's the right thing to do? Locke is starting with rights in the plural, and one of the rights is to choose what you think is good. Now, one of the reasons why Locke is a really complicated theorist is because he wrote a book pseudonymously called The Reasonableness of Christianity. And in it, he argues for a kind of absolutely latitudinarian, really broad church approach. He wants a kind of really capacious Church of England which is open to everybody who can sign up to the basic idea that Jesus is the Messiah. You don't have to sign up to the idea that Jesus is the Son of God. You don't have to sign up to the Trinity on this kind of picture. You don't have to sign up to a theory of the atonement. You don't have to sign up to an understanding of communion. You don't have to sign up to an ecclesiology. It's really, really kind of lowest common denominator Christianity. So the million-dollar question in Locke studies is that Locke setting out for political reasons an understanding of the church? Or is that Locke actually saying, applying my method, where we only look at stuff that's scientific and repeatable, applying my method, is this where I have landed? Because if that is where he is, he's basically a Unitarian. So it's really interesting. Lots of biblical material going on, lots of proto-Enlightenment thought going on. He's big and influential in the Glorious Revolution. He's also big and influential in the United States. A couple of interesting things. as well about his biography. At one point, he was doing some work for Charles II, and before they fell out, and he got paid with shares in the Royal African Company. So he ended up with shares in one of the first slave-owning companies. He also was asked, as a kind of lawyer, to do the drafting for the Constitution of the Carolinas. And he drafted the Constitution in a way that allowed for slavery. So there are a couple of other interesting things about his story. So you've got a guy who, on the one hand, believes in human equality, but on the other hand, is drafting a constitution that allows for slavery. There are sort of foreruns there of George Whitfield, the great evangelist, who found that he couldn't run his orphanage in Georgia without slave labor. So having, and despite a consistent antagonism to the cruelty towards slaves, ended up owning some. So that's Locke. I could spend ages talking about Locke. We run forward 100 years. And when we run forward 100 years, we find ourselves with a couple of revolutions. One in America and one in France. And there are two great figures who are both on side with the American Revolution. Thomas Paine, who's an American with quite a lot of experience and exposure to Europe, and Edmund Burke, who's an Irishman in the UK's Parliament, who is deeply concerned about the way in which the East India Company are treating the Indians. And they are both on side when it comes to the American Revolution. They both see it as a just response to tyranny. But they divide sharply when it comes to the French Revolution. Yuval Levin is an American commentator who's written a book called The Great Debate, looking at the two of them. It's a really, really good book. Lots of his other stuff as well is really, really good. He's quite an insightful American political commentator who's able to look back at the history of things, where American politics are today, what the way forward might be. He's written a book called Time to Build, thinking about how we get beyond polarization. So I'd recommend anything by him you can get your hands on, long or short. Paine pitches this idea of individual rights. So Paine in The Rights of Man says, society grants the citizen nothing. Every man is a proprietor in society, draws on the capital as a matter of right. So Paine is going for rights before responsibility. He's going for individuals before society. He's not talking about intergenerational debts. So whereas Edmund Burke is saying, you know, we owe a gratitude to the previous generations who have given us the good things about our country. You know, there may be things in the history of the US or the history of England or the history of Poland that we want to question, but there are also blessings and benefits that we are inheriting and for which we ought to be grateful, and we ought to be thinking about what we leave future generations with. That's kind of essential to Burkean conservatism. But for Paine, it's about the individual. And the individual conceived of as an owner, as a proprietor. So you're getting here a sort of mirror image of where France had got itself to. So whereas in the UK, thanks to our Civil War and the Commonwealth period and the Glorious Revolution, we'd ended up with this kind of balance between the Crown and Parliament, this balance between the landowners and the king. In France, you'd had Louis XIV, the Sun King, who was the absolute monarch. And when he's overthrown, you get Paine acting as the theorist for the idea that every individual becomes an absolute monarch. Untrammeled rights of ownership, ownership understood as dominion. That's the kind of picture that's there. And this meant that the French Revolution, with its Declaration of the Rights of Man, had this slogan, ni Dieu ni maître, neither God nor master. Because under Louis XIV and his successors, the French Catholic Church had just become a department of state. And there was effectively no religious toleration there. So you couldn't get married, for example, for the period in the 18th century in France, unless you got married in front of a Catholic priest. Well, simply, there was no form of civil marriage that was available to you unless you went through that ceremony. Now, what happens after that is that actually, once you work your way through Napoleon, you see the idea of human rights and natural rights going into eclipse. So in the 19th century, the philosophy that kind of, early 19th century, the philosophy that's dominating in England is exemplified by the great professor at UCL, Jeremy Bentham. And Jeremy Bentham, the founder of utilitarianism, says, job of government is to do whatever makes for the greatest happiness of the greatest number. Now, notice there, that's kind of aggregating. It's not about individuals anymore. And Bentham described the idea of rights as nonsense and the idea of natural rights as nonsense on stilts. And that's not because he hadn't been exposed to the idea. Jeremy Bentham had been a student of William Blackstone, the first professor, a Wernerian professor of English civil law, at the University of Oxford. He sat in the lectures. He'd heard Blackstone expound a Christian theory of natural law. And Bentham just went, no. So you see that coming through in the 19th century, and you see it coupled with a theory of law called legal positivism that says the law is just what the sovereign says it is. Law is simply the commands of the sovereign. Now, that means that departs from natural law because it means there's no necessary connection between law and the good anymore. So if the objective good had gone missing in Locke's philosophy, it's now gone missing from legal philosophy. So you're left with a situation where law is simply what the bloke in charge says it is. And so long as it makes most people happy, there are no protections for minorities or individuals. What?
The legal.
It's called legal positivism. And it's basically a source theory of law. You identify law by its pedigree. So if in the 1930s, Hitler is the sovereign. And if Hitler says, for the greater good of the German people, the Jews and the Romans and the gays all need to be exterminated or excluded from society, there's no reason, according to those theories, no reason in principle, according to those theories, not to go with it. So it's always poignant to be doing this talk here. We are about an hour south of Auschwitz. And on two occasions I've been to this conference, we've been to Auschwitz during the conference week. And you are going to go, well, it's an emotional experience. It couldn't be anything but. And what you see is the application of technology to dehumanize people. If you want to understand how you get yourself to gross human rights abuses, you have to start by not thinking about the people you are dealing with as people, which is why the Nazis took away the names of everybody when they went in. It's why the Nazis separated the men from the women. It's why they gave them work that was impossible to do. It's almost as if all the kind of good gifts of God in creation that are there in Genesis 1 and 2, family, rewarding work, meaning, identity, significance, demonically stripped away as people went through those doors. Yeah. The devil just mocking what God had given and done. And so as the horrors of those camps emerge at the end of the Second World War, and as the Western powers are hearing about similar things happening in the gulags in Siberia, where Stalin is sending his opponents, they're looking around for a theory that will enable them to build an international consensus to hold governments to account. Legal positivism is a busted flush. We need something different. And so thinkers like Jacques Maritain, Charles Habib, who's a Lebanese politician, start reaching back for this idea of natural rights, now renamed as human rights. And so you see this idea come through. You see these texts that are written in 1947 and 1958. They're really interesting texts, quite complicated, quite different in many ways. I'm deeply upset that I don't enjoy one of my rights under the UN Declaration of Human Rights. Article 22 of the UN Declaration of Human Rights gives everybody the right to paid holiday. Sadly, as someone self-employed, I don't have that. So no employer is paying for me whilst I'm here doing this. So you can read that declaration as a kind of aspirational view of what the good life looked like in the mid-20th century. It's quite carefully balanced as well. Towards the back end of the UN Declaration, there are everybody has duties towards their country and has a right to participate in its civil service, its administration, its public life, and so on. So there's a balance there between the rights and responsibilities that's quite carefully calibrated. But what we've seen since then is a kind of evolution in rights thinking. So the rights that people have today and the way these rights are construed are quite different from the way in which they were seen in the immediate aftermath of the Second World War. Rights have been extended into all sorts of areas and developed in all sorts of ways that if you had stopped the proponents of the 1947 and 1958 documents and said, did you know these documents might one day be used to argue for same-sex marriage? They said, what? How? And some of the arguments that crop up today and ways things are used are things that were simply inconceivable. The reason why they weren't explicitly excluded is because it was unimaginable. Now, this gives rise, I think, to a pretty lively debate about whether there is something wrong with the way that we use rights language today, whether there's something wrong with the concept of rights in itself. The debate is quite difficult to explain. I know it's quite difficult to explain because two of the major proponents of this kind of debate took about 4.5 books between them to actually work out what they were really arguing about. So, rights language starts with this idea, or at least it starts with this idea in the thought of Nicholas Waltersdorf. So Nicholas Waltersdorf is an American Christian philosopher, and he would be kind of the foremost philosophical Christian defender of rights language today, probably. And he wants to say, well, as Christians, we have often focused on our personal guilt and our personal responsibility to God for the wrongs that we have done. Now, that, in secular terms, and it may be that David touches on this later on, is a kind of perpetrator view of the world. But Waltersdorf wants to say, well, actually, as well as this kind of perpetrator view of the world that focuses on the wrongs that we have done, there's also a kind of victim view of the world that is about the wrongs that have been done to us. And he would say that you can capture both of those perspectives being picked up in the Lord's Prayer. So where we pray that we will be forgiven as we forgive those who've sinned against us, we're picking up on both of those dimensions. But what he wants to say is that those are different dimensions. They're not the flip side of one another. I tend to illustrate it like this. I used to do car crash cases. And I did two car crash cases that particularly stick in my mind. One involved a guy who was driving at 70 miles an hour on the wrong side of the road, not paying attention, car coming in the opposite direction. He's got a car full of passengers. He suddenly realizes he's about to have a head-on collision with the car. So he swings the wheel to the left. He goes into a lay-by. He goes through a sign marking the entrance to the Levi. He's headed towards a burger van, which is serving snacks and coffees to people who are sat at tables and chairs. He goes through the tables and chairs. He hits the burger van. He spins the burger van through 180 degrees. There was a three-year-old child around. The sound of him hitting the brakes and swerving caused the parents to get the three-year-old child out of the way. The angle at which he hit the burger van and the fact that it moved rather than staying static reduced the force of the impact on him and his passengers. The only person who suffered any injuries at all in that accident was the woman who was cooking the burgers in the burger van, who suffered some broken ribs. Now, if you are asking about the level of moral responsibility that guy has for his bad driving, it's pretty high. You know, it was utterly appalling. It was totally reckless. If we're thinking about the kind of wrongs that it ended up causing, the victim, pretty low. By contrast, I did a case involving a couple who were coming back from a day at the seaside. It was one of those days where everybody had been to the beach. It's a long queue of traffic on the one road out. They're on a motorbike. So they're going down between the two lanes of traffic. The guy gets to the corner, loses control of the bike. Might have hit something. Might have been a bit of oil on the road. Might have been whatever. His girlfriend came off the back of the bike, went under a car, coming in the opposite direction, broke her back. Never walk again. Paralyzed from the waist down. Much, much less moral responsibility on the part of the rider. Much, much more harm caused to the victim. So it's those kind of scenarios, Walterstorff is saying, mean that actually, when we think about things from a perpetrator perspective, when we think about things from a victim perspective, it's not always just two sides of the coin. It's really sort of two dimensions of what happens in our fallen world. And so he says we need the language of rights as part of our moral vocabulary in order to give voice to wrongs, not just to guilt. Now, he does go slightly overboard because he then thinks that he can get the whole of justice out of rights, which I think is not, it's an ambitious and unsustainable claim. So that's one element to do with rights language. There's another question about how you conceptualize rights. So one way of thinking about rights is as possessions, as things which belong to me. When I first heard that suggestion as a definition of rights, I thought surely that is a caricature of rights language by its opponents. Because I first come across this in the work of Joan Lockwood O'Donovan, who does not like rights at all. But actually, H.L.A. Hart, who was a 20th century British legal philosopher, massive legal positivist, he wrote an article called The Concept of Rights in 1959, in which he basically says rights are things that belong to me. So that's an accurate description of one view of rights. The other view of rights is that rights are an aspect of relationships. So, for example, if you had turned up this morning to discover that I was talking about the new Disney Plus program, How I Met Your Father, and I was intending to use my hour and a half to talk about that rather than to talk about the topic listed, you'd have the right to be annoyed about that, because the aspect of the relationship we have for the purposes of this hour and a half is that you have certain legitimate expectations that I will do my best to stick to topic. Equally, if instead of being 5 minutes late, you'd all been an hour and a half late, I'd have had the right to be annoyed about that because, you know, again, the relationship that we have at the moment is one that if I'm going to give up my time to come and talk, I expect you to be here rather than off at the swimming pool. It'll be warmer this afternoon anyway. So those are two quite different ways of thinking about rights, because one, things which belong to me, it's kind of me-centered, and it's kind of me against the world. The other one is much more actually, to understand a right, you always have to put it in the context of who the people are, what their relationship is, and so on. What I think we see, therefore, today, is two families of conceptions of rights, one of which I think owes itself unequivocally to pain, and the other one which is harking back to the medieval and classical ways of thinking about our place in the world, our relationship to the good, our relationship to what is right. And you sort of have Locke navigating his way sort of mostly over here, but already making some fatal moves towards the other side. So one conception of rights is that human rights are about creating space for human beings to live with dignity. Space where they're able to worship God sincerely, space where they're able to live in peace and security, space where they're able to be involved and serve in the common life, space where they're able to raise a family in accordance with their convictions, space where they're able to enjoy rewarding and productive work. That's one kind, and that's a pretty clear, but also pretty defined vision of what human flourishing looks like. So that vision has got a kind of conception of the good which it is drawing on for its understanding of where rights are and where their place is in the moral universe. The other conception is starting with Thomas Paine's kind of idea of individuals who were proprietors, and therefore, of course, you know, the English law view of ownership of land is, unless I'm causing a nuisance to my neighbour, I can do what I like with my land, and if what I want to do is dig massive holes in it or blow it up or whatever I want to do with it, burn plastic on it, you know, I can do all of those kinds of things unless I'm constrained only by my next door neighbor's set of rights. So that becomes increasingly about a freedom from many claims from God. So, you know, I'm the one who makes up my mind about what my morality is. There's no external authority that gets to tell me. I'm the one who gets to decide the extent, if at all, that I get involved in serving others. I'm the one, I operate as an individual primarily. I don't see myself as part of a unit. So that's consistent with, you know, if I get fed up with my wife, I trade her in for a younger model. If I don't fancy monogamy, I can ignore that. And we've now got a label for that. I get to define myself. I'm not constrained by my biology in any way, in terms of how I see myself or who I identify as, and so on. And one way of tracing what's been happening since the human rights instruments were adopted just after the Second World War is a move away from one conception of rights to another conception of rights. So the legal instruments remain the same, but the way that they're understood, the basic framework of assumptions that litigants and increasingly judges bring to them is moving from one across to the other. That's a case that's interestingly but slightly problematically made by Samuel Moyne, who wrote a book called Christian Human Rights, in which he tries to argue from the perspective that the Christian vision of human rights after the Second World War was a bad thing and what we've got now is a good thing. But he's quite clearly and picking out explicitly the way in which there were significant Christian influences on the way that human rights develop. I always at this point want to get, if not before, want to give a shout out to Charles Habib. Charles Habib was Greek Orthodox Lebanese. He's the one who pretty single-handedly made sure that the right to freedom of religion includes the right to change your religion. And he understood that because living in his multi-religious context in Lebanon, Syria, he knew how important it was going to be for people to be able to give up Islam if that's what they wanted to do, and because they believed that, you know, Christianity was true, for example. There's another issue relating to human rights. Why do we think only humans have rights? Or, to put it differently, do we think that humans have qualitatively different rights from other animals or things that are inanimate? So, secular theories of human rights have to explain why it is that we think that individuals should have claims that are recognized in law or in morality. And the way that this is usually done, the most promising attempt to do this, it is around the idea that human persons have rights. Now, that word persons is important because this is a way of identifying some members of the human species as having particular capabilities or capacities that mean that their rights should be respected. So you set a bar and you say, well, actually, you know, if you can reason, if you can support yourself independently, if absent medical intervention, you're going to stay alive, then you count as a human person. One of those criterion, for example. Now, the problem with those criteria is that they give you a situation where you discover that there are some members of the human species who don't fit the bill. They've got Alzheimer's disease. They're in a persistent vegetative state. They're not yet born. They're a very young child. So you'll find some people like Peter Singer who will quite unabashedly say, yep, absolutely, when we're talking about rights, human persons have rights and others who don't fit, members of the human species who don't fit that bill don't. Now, some don't like that. So what do? Well, you lower the bar for what counts so that you make sure that you include all members of the human species. Problem is, if you lower the bar, it gets quite difficult to explain why it is that my extremely cute, lovely, and very intelligent dog or dolphins or gorillas don't also qualify. And so in America, we've seen litigation on behalf of the Non-Human Rights Association, who've argued that various chimpanzees, bonobos, and gorillas count as persons for the purposes of America's human rights legislation. They're being held illegally in captivity, and they ought to be released so that they can take their place in society. Now, I get upset about this because I think that's frankly sizist. I'm a massive fan of a gibbon, the little ape running around. I just have not seen anybody arguing in favor of their rights. Look at the guy with, you know, sat there. Look, you can see how sad he is that he's not being given his rights. So now that's a right of necessity, I think. So you can see that if you lower the bar, you start running into problems, which is why the most convincing account of rights that says that whatever rights other entities may have, there's something special about human beings and all members of the human species. The most convincing account is one that says that we're made by God, that we're made in the image of God. Yeah, that's really important. One of the justifications for casteism within certain versions of Hinduism is the idea that the untouchables were not made by God in the same way that all other castes were. And of course, historically and theologically, that Jesus demonstrates the fundamental equality of all human beings in his life and his actions. He's not born in a palace, he's born in a stable. He undertakes manual work. He ends up as a refugee as a child. His interactions with women show them a dignity and respect. The way that he deals with foreigners, whether it's the Roman invading powers or the Samaritan woman or the Syrophoenician woman, show his care. How he deals with the madman who's living in the tomb. And then he dies the death of a slave and a criminal. You know, if you want to understand how the idea of human equality got into the West's imagination in such a way that it seems blindingly obvious to almost everybody today, it's actually just through the repetition of the Christian story, the story of that begins at Christmas and finishes at Easter, but catches the whole of Jesus' life. And David Bentley Hart makes this point incredibly forcibly, that the idea of human equality was anathema in the ancient world. And it would never have stuck in our society but for the gospel and the example of Jesus. So that gives us these kind of two foundations for these two different conceptions. Capability rights, rights only for the persons, rights only for the choosers. And in order to work out who has rights, it's human plus blank, please insert desired capability here. Whereas a dignity approach talks about human rights for all human beings, rights for all members of the human species that God has chosen. Immediately after this conference, Chris McCrudden is talking about dignity in London back on Thursday 26th. So any of you who made it back and need more lectures at that point, there are still spaces available for his lecture at 6 o'clock. So there's my HLA Hart quote about rights being seen as things which belong to me, possessed or owned by or belonging to individuals. I just find that kind of striking as the kind of background conception of rights that lots of people who aren't Christians have implicitly absorbed. Probably couldn't articulate it as clearly and succinctly as Hart did, but that's there. So, that kind of rights as things which belong to me conception of rights tends to create a world in which you have individuals and everybody else. The individual, I have my rights, others aren't giving me my rights, so I ask the state to enforce my rights. Now, what's getting soft-pedaled or excluded or forgotten about in that kind of vision of rights are the goods of community. And also, importantly, the institutions of civil society. So, you know, we, you know, I'm a citizen of the UK, but my lived experience of that is about the town or the borough that I live in. It's about the church that I belong to. It's about the cricket club I'm a member of. It's about the place I work. And each of those has its own distinct way of being in the world, its own distinct culture, its own distinct values. But what we've seen human rights litigation do is constantly chip away at whether the Scouts are allowed to require this, or whether the Christian Union is allowed to demand that of its members in favour of, if I want to go there, then I should be allowed to do that. Now, there are the resources in theory within rights to think about group rights, but in practical terms, what you see is that they are kind of add-on that get talked about afterwards, if at all, and they rarely get given the same weight as individuals. You know, and Walter Stauff is guilty of that in his own writing. His big book that everybody will read, Justice, Rights and Wrong, doesn't talk about group rights at all. You have to keep going in his corpus till about book four and read The Mighty and the Almighty, and then you suddenly discover he's got to develop a theory of group rights. But anybody, you know, I can't imagine that students are like what they were in my day. But in my day, you know, you never read all four books by the person you've been told to read. You just read the first one that was on the reading list and ignored the rest. This is a reminder of Walter Stauff's position. I want to just critique the emphasis on rights a little bit. You've got a couple of thinkers there in the 60s and 70s who were saying, hang on a minute, even that, I mean, this is old for you. None of you were born when all of this was being said. But already you could see people worrying that an overemphasis on rights and an underemphasis on responsibilities was going to be problematic. Did God give the Israelites the Declaration of the Rights of the Israelites? He didn't, did he? He gave them the Ten Commandments. Now, what's interesting is you can turn the Ten Commandments round. So you can say, you know, God has the right to be worshipped exclusively. You can turn around and say, you know, human beings have the right to one day of rest out of seven. I have the right to my wife and my property, and actually I have the right that you don't even think about taking them. The one that's quite tricky is do not bear false witness. That requires a bit of work to turn that around. But you can do it. So given that you can do it, why weren't we given the Declaration of the Rights of the Israelites? Why were the Ten Commandments given? I suspect the answer that any of you who've had brothers or sisters will know is because we need much less encouragement to insist on our rights than we do to remind ourselves of our responsibilities. Every three-year-old child has somehow learnt it's not fair as an extremely powerful tool for raising an interest or a claim. So we kind of instinctively want to look after ourselves and claim our own rights. What we need reminding of is our social responsibilities. What I hope I've done so far is to show both the Christian contribution to the development of human rights, but also some of the secular issues. But there is a definite case that human rights are trading on certain assumptions that only really make sense within a Christian or a monotheistic worldview. Human rights make universal claims. Now, that's kind of interesting, really. We're supposed to be in a post-truth world. Nobody likes objective truth. Human rights claims must therefore be power claims, if post-truth is true. John Gray, who is a very interesting, eclectic British non-humanist atheist philosopher, in an article called Two Cheers for Human Rights, says human rights originated in monotheism. He's tracing there, acknowledging the Christian origins. They depend on the idea that they are part of a single moral law that applies to all human beings everywhere. And he wants to make the point, if you take God out of the picture, where do they come from? Because his answer would be, actually, the only thing that can give us rights, if it's not God, is the state. And the problem is, we want rights to control the way in which the state controls us. So if we're depending on the state to give us our rights, then how can we use rights to control the state? Similar sort of analysis comes from controversial radical orthodox Christian theologian John Milbank. He says, take God out of the picture, these things make no sense. Roger Scruton, even more brutal about human rights. He thinks, talking here about a particular conception of rights, we kill in ourselves piety and gratitude, believing we owe the world nothing and the world owes everything to us. Who's he referencing there? That's Thomas Paine. He's just picking up on Paine's conception of rights. You know, proprietor in society, drawing on the capital as a matter of right. And so he sees human rights, as Francesco Klug did, as coming in to provide us with common values, but actually radically different values from previous generations. Much more all about me, much less about my obligations to others. So instead of living a life that is there to try and make conditions better for myself and for everybody else, I'm living a life where I try and get as much as I can regard that I can get away with. So if human rights are to have a universal force, they need to be objective. The best explanation for objectivity is the existence and nature of God. Without God, human rights end depending on the state. I need to wrap up. Let me try and do that. What I've tried to do is show that human rights are in their origin complicated, that there are significant ways in which I think the way in which they are used today is distorted and unhelpful, but the language is ubiquitous. And I think if we in the UK get rid of our Human Rights Act and replace it by some sort of bill protecting free speech, they're not going to disappear. They're not going to disappear because the UK isn't going to leave the jurisdiction of the European Court of Human Rights. The European Convention of Human Rights is still going to be there. And, of course, lawyers and others are, in our thought patterns, conservative. So we've spent 25 years getting our heads round making arguments in rights terms. And even if we have to refer to a different section of a different act, we're going to carry on using that kind of language. And it will continue to be used in public discourse as well. Which means for those of you in public life, you are going to need to use the language of right. But you're going to need to explain what you mean by rights and what you're thinking about if you're using that language in a different way from others. And there are all sorts of areas now where Christians have an understanding and a conception of a particular thing that is different from the way the conception is perceived of by others. I don't know whether David's going to touch on this later, but social justice, for example, is something that has a specific meaning now, if you are woke, but will have a different meaning if you're Christian. And you need to be aware of that when you're using it. But around the Mediterranean, they used to have what was called the lingua franca, which was a trade language. It was a mixture of French and Italian and Arabic that was used as a language to enable them to trade with one another. In East Asia now, they have what's sometimes called Panglish or Singlish, which is a version of English that enables people involved in trade in Singapore and Taiwan and Hong Kong and Shanghai to trade with one another. Now, they're using a language in both cases, Singlish and lingua franca. They're nobody's first language. When you're at home doing your thinking, you don't do it in that language. But when you're trying to communicate publicly, you pick it up as a way of finding a connection. And that's really, I think, where we ought to be as Christians. I think as Christians, we ought to be thinking about the pursuit of the good. We ought to be thinking about love. We ought to be thinking about duties and responsibilities. And starting with those, when we're thinking about political choices, political solutions, and so on. These are the foundations of the Christian social vision. I would love to talk to you about shalom as the vision that we have as Christians, but I do not have time to do that, so we'll have to pick that up somewhere else. But once we've done our thinking in those terms, when we're trying to explain it to people, we need to be able to do so in the language of rights.